You know, I missed what was right in front of me.
You're listening to award-winning filmmaker Dream Hampton in a moment of startling vulnerability. Hampton admits that when she authored a profile about R&B megastar R. Kelly back in 2000, she'd noticed the very young girls in his entourage. But she dismissed it.
I missed it. You know, I missed what was right in front of me.
This mistake troubles her, and it's part of why she said yes to creating the 6-part docuseries Surviving R. Kelly, which premiered on the Lifetime Network in January of 2019. The series features the distressing testimonies of young women who allege they'd survived appalling physical, mental, and sexual abuse by the artist.
There's a difference between R. Kelly and Robert. R. Kelly is this fun, laughing, loving guy. But Robert is the devil.
Kelly is accused of videotaping himself having sex with an underage girl.
Taking advantage of minors will not be tolerated.
Jurors found him not guilty on all charges.
Robert has said all along he would be clear to these terrible charges.
Shame on you!
Shame on you!
Shame on you!
Shame on you!
Milk R. Kelly!
A little more than a month after the series premiered, this happened in Chicago, Illinois.
Kelly has been indicted by a grand jury on 10 counts of aggravated criminal sexual abuse against 4 alleged victims.
5 months later, it was this.
The R&B singer found himself in handcuffs once again last night when he was arrested while walking his dog outside of his Trump Tower home in Chicago. He is facing a 13-count indictment in the Northern District of Illinois, including charges of child porn and obstruction of justice. And there is a separate sealed indictment in Brooklyn that we should learn more about later today.
And then on Monday, more than 3 years after Hampton's series shook the music industry, we got this news.
In one of the most prominent trials of the Me Too era, a federal jury has convicted R&B superstar R. Kelly on all counts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and on today's episode of The Takeaway, we begin with the artist and activist Dream Hampton. Dream Hampton is the showrunner and executive producer of the docuseries Surviving R. Kelly. Dream, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Melissa.
You were the first person that I emailed yesterday when I heard the verdict. How did you learn about it and how did you feel?
I've been doing this wonderful thing where I have been leaving my phone in a drawer while I run errands. And so I came back to it and I guess it was around 4 o'clock and there were 30 messages, and I was stunned. You know, I remember 2008 and I remember his acquittal. And I can't say that any of this I expected. Maybe some other people associated with production did, but you mean making Surviving R. Kelly about a 50-year-old R&B singer who hadn't had a hit in a decade and whose predation had been an open secret for nearly 3 decades, I didn't expect that there would be charges. I didn't expect there'd be trials, and I certainly didn't expect a conviction.
Let's go back to your decision to pursue the story, to tell the story. Why that story then, especially given, as you just said, 50-year-old R&B singer hasn't made a hit in a minute.
You know, I really messed up. In October of 2000, so that means this is back when there were magazines. I must have gone out to Chicago in July or August if it had a street day of October, November. I did a cover story of R. Kelly. In fact, the photo of that cover story became evidence in the 2008 trial about him. And it was a profile. It was a profile about his habits, about how he worked in the studio. And I missed the real story. You know, there were young girls in the studio, but that wasn't something that I hadn't seen before. I was in the studio when Puff was working with Total. I was in the studio when Mary J. Blige was just out of high school singing backgrounds for Father MC. Like, I've been in studios before, and I missed it. You know, I missed what was right in front of me. And about a month after the cover story that I did about R. Kelly in Vibe magazine was released, Jim DeRogatis began his reporting about Tiffany Hawkins, a girl who went to the police, Chicago Police Department, as a post-teenager and alleged that R. Kelly had abused her as a minor. And that article became evidence that this Aaliyah marriage, which had happened when I profiled R. Kelly and which I'd asked him about during the interview, he got very defensive and seemed surprised that I would even ask him. But that became evidence that this wasn't some weird spring, winter love or whatever euphemisms we have for predation, you know, that there was a pattern to his predation. Shortly after that, of course, a video came out of him sexually abusing a 14-year-old who turned out to be Sparkle's niece. And so I felt like when I was invited onto this project, this wasn't my idea. I was hired to be showrunner and executive producer of this. I couldn't say no. I knew that it would be secondhand trauma, that it would be difficult. I knew that we were in a new landscape. I wasn't really thinking about Me Too. In fact, I was thinking about the way that one is so easily trolled and doxxed in this moment. And so all of those things were nothing compared to this duty I felt to, I don't know, right or wrong. And also I'm from this generation, you know, and I was around and I was in this business as a music journalist when he was getting away with all of this. And so I just owed it, you know, to these survivors to do the best job that I could do.
Who else owes these survivors? Who else missed it either through actually missing it or by choosing to turn away from it?
I mean, well, we can talk about kind of the ecosystem of enablers, you know, and that is exists on a corporate level. It exists amongst his peers. On a corporate level, there was a lot made of the fact that John Legend was the only celebrity in surviving R. Kelly. And I did an interview early on. I think it was my very first interview about the docuseries. And I was asked why he was the only one. And I named all of the people that I'd invited who didn't come on. And that became a headline. And sure, I'm not backing off of that. I did ask those people and I asked them for good reason. But who I wanted more than his peer celebrities were the people who ran Jive Records, for instance, his record label. Barry Weiss called him several times trying to get him to come on camera. People at that record label, he had a hand-picked few women, quite frankly, who he would only work with. I don't know, I asked Stephen Henderson, who was responsible for producing BET's award shows and who gave him almost 12 minutes to perform this epic kind of homage to Sam Cooke years after, we'd seen a tape of him raping a 14-year-old. I wanted all of these people to come on camera, not to have a gotcha moment, you know. I wanted Jay-Z to come on and talk about, you know, as a 50-year-old man to reflect on, you know, the decisions that he made to make a record like Not Guilty with R. Kelly, to go on tour with him after he was, acquitted. And some of those reasons might have been really pedantic. It may have been that they had a contract to do this tour and he would have been in breach of contract, which he ended up being anyway when they canceled it. But, you know, I wanted to hear some of these explanations and I wanted people to be willing to possibly be reflective, and they were unwilling.
Your point about maybe it was just a contract. There is the banality of evil that Hannah Arendt, of course, warns us of, the ways that we can all participate in it, even if we are not enacting it, we're enabling it. And I wonder if, in addition to those who owe the survivors and those you've named here, those of us who consume the music, those who even right now are in social media saying, well, but he's a genius. What do we do with a musical genius who is a serial sex abuser and a pedophile?
You know, I don't have the answer to this question, but I can tell you it doesn't begin with or end with R. Kelly, right? I know that the women who began Mute R. Kelly hoped to not just deplatform him, but the boycott and sanction and most importantly, the divestment was about stopping income from coming, from flowing towards R. Kelly, mostly live concerts. Is where artists are earning their income and have been for the past decade. And that money was directly responsible for the staff that, you know, R. Kelly told which girls would eat on a particular night and who wouldn't, who was on punishment, who was disallowed from coming out of the studio room that he'd locked them in and was disallowed bathroom privileges. So there was an operation. This is why he was charged with a RICO charge, right? There was an operation, a criminal operation, that your concert dollars were flowing directly towards your funding, right? But this question about art versus artist is a test that I failed personally. I'm able to turn away from R. Kelly, even though I do think he is probably the greatest R&B singer of my generation. Well, besides Mary J. Blige.
I was like, are we about to do this conversation? Because no, we could have this Mary conversation.
J. Mary J. She wins. But I wasn't able when Pearl Clegg wrote Mad About Miles after Quincy Troup's autobiography with him came out. And we learned about the kind of serial abuser he was. I may have been successful of a Miles Davis boycott for a couple of months. And then I fell in love and I was listening to Miles Davis again. So I have not passed that test all of the time of separating the art from the artist or boycotting an artist because of their personal terrible behavior. I would like, if people are unable to, you know, stop listening to R. Kelly, stop streaming him, then I would like these music companies, the Spotify's and the other companies, to establish a fund, the restitution that's going to be necessary to begin the healing journeys for these victims is mammoth. And we're hearing reports that he's broke, that he has a negative income. So, if you can't stop listening to R. Kelly, let that money go towards his victims.
Let's talk about the survivors. We've been talking about Kelly, but let's talk about the survivors. Obviously, not only did you provide this extraordinary and extremely painful to watch series, but you were in the room, you encountered, you engaged, and undoubtedly made choices about what we would see and what we would hear. Can you talk to me a bit about that process?
You know, I've been thinking about the process a lot lately, and I've been thinking about And this may, you know, be a conversation for some other place, but I've been thinking a lot about what documentary can do and what it can't. You know, first and foremost, the studio was interested in protecting itself from libel, from being sued, from litigation. And that meant that while we had lawyers who were policing my interview questions, making sure that they weren't leading, making sure that they could stand up as a transcript and say a lawsuit, we didn't have therapists on the set. You know, we didn't, that investment wasn't made. And these women were reopening wounds and trauma and reliving that for my cameras for hours under hot lights. I mean, we would take breaks and then they needed them often, but none of the survivors, and I interviewed every one of them and their parents, none of them sat for me for less than 4 hours. Mm. It was necessary, you know, for me to play a role that, quite frankly, in this, you know, in the world of sexual victims and crimes, I was charged as a producer on this to play the prosecutor, you know? And prosecutors aren't my favorite people, which means that I was required, if someone told me a story that was awful, I was required to say, to ask the same questions detectives ask, for instance, like, who else did you tell about this and when? And may I have their contact? Like, I had to do all of the kind of verification that we think is happening in the criminal justice system. And that's not a role that I'm proud of necessarily. I would have much rather reached out to them as a survivor myself, as a Black woman, as a sister. But that wasn't the role that I was charged with doing on the set in order for this project to make it to television. Does that make sense?
Oh, it does. And as I listen to you say it, I wonder how you surviving R. Kelly, how you, as a survivor, as a mom of a daughter, how you made it through day to day.
Well, I had something that not one of the women that I interviewed had, which was a history of engaging in therapy, you know, and some resources to take care of myself. You know, they were my own personal resources. We don't get rich making documentaries. I don't know if that's a surprise to people. but I did have this history of knowing how valuable therapy was. So I immediately, you know, put myself back in therapy. I wish that we could have done that for the survivors. Whatever secondhand trauma I experienced was nothing compared to them having to relive this for the cameras, knowing that they'd be opening themselves up for derision, knowing that in this social media age where they all have accounts, most of them public, that you would see the kind of comments that you saw even on Geronda Pace's Instagram yesterday, you know, they're still being trolled. And that never feels good, you know? So I made it through, but I wasn't the most important person on the set. And by the way, yes, I had to do all of the interviews and hold these stories, but everyone was affected. Our sound guy, you know, this like white guy in his early 30s had never heard anything like this. Everyone who worked on this project, the women who had to pre-interview the victims from the team, they had to hold these stories. So everyone was affected.
Why do you think we care so little about the assault, the abuse, the actual missing Black girls and women? Why is it so easy for us to literally look at it happening to them, to watch it on video, and to make a story that it's somehow their fault?
Yeah, that's a hard one, you know, and growing up Black and female, this isn't a new story to me, you know, it's not a new story. There's a legacy of Black feminism that I certainly didn't make something as amazing as Ntozake's, you know, For Color Girls, or as strong as Alice Walker's Color Purple. And those are just two examples, you know, from a particular generation. Black feminists been taught us that this cognitive dissonance is, you know, something that we have to struggle against. Our impulse to protect Black men often outranks any, you know, notion that we'd have to care and love for not just Black girls and women, but, you know, Black children. I mean, R. Kelly has, he's victimized people on a gender spectrum. And by the way, R. Kelly himself was a victim, you know? And there is this way that we fail, and it's not disconnected to white supremacy. It's not disconnected to a criminal justice system that has framed innocent Black men for sexual crimes. We know this history. It has been written about. And it seems like we have to start at the beginning every generation. And that, to me, is exhausting.
Now, I was moved by Hampton's willingness to be vulnerable about messing up and missing the signs of Kelly's predation. I have to say, I felt that too. When I first moved to Chicago in late 1999, I started an educational enrichment program for high-achieving juniors at Kenwood Academy High School. Now, as a newcomer to the city, I didn't know that it was the same high school R. Kelly attended as a student. But I got to know the dedicated leadership there, the terrific students of the high school. So many of those young people from that program, I'm still in contact and relationship with them. But back then, I started to hear rumors and warnings. People saying, Professor Harris, make sure you know where your kids are at all times. Make sure you're counting heads in the programs because sometimes he comes by. Now, what I and the entire city learned in 2000 is that the he was R. Kelly. That year, Kelly faced charges of sexually assaulting a 14-year-old student from Kenwood Academy High School. And that was more than 20 years ago. And like Dream Hampton, I carry a certain weight, a guilt, a knowing that we all knew that there was this open secret of abuse swirling around us. But honestly, I think most of us felt helpless. We weren't lawyers. We didn't have the kind of evidence that you could take to court. So feeling helpless to stop him, we just drew the children closer to us. We sought to protect them with our vigilance, with our care. But of course, we know that for decades, there were always just enough who slipped beyond our fingertips, beyond our arms, and through the cracks. And they became vulnerable to Kelly and to his abuse. Let's keep going now with Dream Hampton. Now, Dream, you mentioned Alice Walker, Ensisoke Shange, Toni Morrison, bell hooks. It's a reminder that we're not just survivors as Black girls and women. We're also creators. We're not just the sum of all the horror that is occurring to our bodies and our minds and our souls. You're a creator, and I'm constantly finding you backstage at events that I didn't even know you were producing. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your joy projects. When you're doing work that maybe feels a little bit less like Black girl salvation and a little bit more like just Black girl magic.
Yeah, I think you remember me backstage with a headphone set on the set of Black Girls Rock, where I got to work with Regina King this year at the Oscars. Steven Soderbergh invited me onto his team, and that was like so great to figure out in this moment where Derek Chauvin had just been convicted, like how to keep her buoyant and also have some, you know, to be in the moment. And so, you know, I'm built for this. Like, I'm okay dealing with the darkness in my work. And I don't know that if you were to look at my resume, that there'd be much evidence of joy, but in my real life, and you know, you've been to my dinner parties. I like to cook for my friends.
Food and the music. My husband, Jim, yes. Like, have you been listening to this playlist? This is amazing.
Yes. I will be up until 3 a.m. curating a playlist and trying to figure out, you know, what appetizers would be great with what main dish I'm serving. So, I mean, that's the life that I'm living, and I'm trying to create some pleasure and ease in it. I began my career as, say, a writer by calling out Dr. Dre for abusing Dee Barnes. So there has been like heavy lifting and hard work, and maybe that'll change. I'm doing a piece right now for the LA Opera that is about the opposite of that. But I don't get that many opportunities to do that. And it's not because I'm more courageous than anyone else, but it's because I'm willing to do that dark work. And I don't know that that'll change, but I'll continue to have good playlists and great dinner parties, even as I do this work.
Dream Hampton is a filmmaker, activist, and executive producer of the docuseries Surviving R. Kelly. Dream, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
And we also wanted to hear from you, the community of The Takeaway. And here's what you told us about your reaction to the guilty verdict.
Hi, my name is April M., and I'm calling from Horicon, Wisconsin. And unfortunately, it took forever. But, you know, when things like this come to light, it's good to see justice. Feeling bad for the victims, of course.
Hi, this is Jennifer. I'm calling about the R. Kelly verdict. To me, it should have been done 20 years ago. He's been grooming girls ever since Aaliyah. To me, how he rots in jail the rest of his life. I am a rape survivor, and To me, this is finally a victory for us, and we deserve this. And finally, it shows money does not help everything. And to R. Kelly, I'm glad you got caught. And to all the victims, I hope you get the help you need.
And Aisha sent us a tweet saying, quote, well, it's about time. Regardless of their skin color, too many rich men have been getting away with so much ish. As I'm typing these words, many young women are being sexually abused just for wanting to start or advance their career. It's an ongoing issue. Thank you for tweeting to us, for calling us. It is always so good to hear from you guys. Now remember, send us a voice memo with your thoughts at takeawaycallers@gmail.com.